Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my pleasure to introduce Jacob Weisberg today on his book, Ronald Reagan. Jacob was the chairman of the Slate Group and the former editor of Slate magazine. All of you know about Slate. He's also written on Bush and his Bushisms was very, very popular for quite a while when Bush was making his Bushisms. To entertain us all. And he has a great new biography on Ronald Reagan that tries to show, you know, all the different angles because, as I said about Thomas More, you know, that image of the Hans Holbein picture that went down that's so famous kind of, like, gives everybody the whole idea about what the man is because people think in images. And the same thing has happened to Ronald Reagan in a lot less time. We do this all the time. It's always interesting to find somebody dig in and say, why is it that somebody ended up being important enough that you want to have an image of him to take down into history with you. So, Jacob, thank you very much for coming tonight.
Thank you, George, for that introduction. I think that's almost certainly the first time Ronald Reagan was ever compared to Thomas More. And probably, I'm not really sure where to go with that. It's provocative. It's great to be back at the Commonwealth Club. I spoke here when my first book came out almost 20 years ago. I think I was in the slightly grander place across the hall, but a lot of things have been downsized. And this is a modest, short book. This book's part of a series. Arthur Schlesinger, the great American historian, had this idea that there should be a standard biography of every president of the United States, partly as a way to examine the presidency as an institution, and partly to have a more digestible, accessible, less academic summary story to telling the story of each of the presidents. Different journalists and different historians have drawn different lots and had different assignments. My friend Gal Collins got William Henry Harrison. William Henry Harrison was only president for 30 days, and he was basically in a coma the whole time. And the book is supposed to really focus on the presidency. And so when I got started, she said, "Boy, I left nothing on the cutting room floor. Everything I found out about William Henry Harrison is in that book." Ronald Reagan was really the opposite problem. There are a lot of long books about Reagan that tell the story in great detail. The exercise here was really distilling it down and trying to ask what was essential about the story to tell the story in truncated terms, but also to try to come up with a new sort of interpretation because Reagan has somewhat famously defeated biographers, most famously Edmund Morris, who wrote this book Dutch, which you know a lot of people regard as a travesty, in which he tells the story through an invented friend of Reagan's, and he writes poems to Reagan, and he sort of, to say he lost his mind would go too far, but he was very, very frustrated by his inability to understand Reagan. And he was frustrated after getting this tremendous access. I don't think any historian has ever had access to a sitting president to the extent that Morris did in Reagan's second term. They basically, the White House allowed him to be a fly on the wall, even though he wasn't an official biographer. It was an independent biography. But to his dismay, he found out that Reagan in public was exactly the same as Reagan in private. And he would ask Reagan these questions about his childhood, about all sorts of things. And essentially, he got the same things Reagan said when he was speaking in front of a camera. And he sort of couldn't crack the case. And I think so many people have found Reagan impenetrable. They haven't been able to come to any understanding of what it is that made him tick, to really come up with a sort of theory of the case. So I modestly thought that would be worth trying to do. I focused on a few aspects of Reagan's career in particular. I had some questions about him I really wanted to answer. And I came away completely fascinated and absorbed by the man. And I think I learned some things that really surprised me about Reagan. So I want to talk about a few of those tonight, and then we can throw it open for questions, and I will try to answer anything that you're wondering about Reagan. I wanted to get started by talking a little bit about Reagan's childhood. because I think it's really important and in trying to understand him. Reagan grew up in Western Illinois, downstate Illinois, in a series of towns. He lived in 10 different homes by the time he was 10 years old. And the reason he lived in so many different homes was that his father was an alcoholic and kept losing his job. And they kept going to a new place to start, try to start fresh. At one point, they moved to Chicago, and his father was a shoe salesman, and he had a job working in one of the early department stores on State Street, got arrested for public drunkenness. They had to leave Chicago, went back to Western Illinois. They finally ended up in Dixon, which was the town where Reagan spent most of his teenage years, first time they were in a home for more than a year. It was a really troubled household he grew up in. Moving that much, he didn't get to make any, couldn't keep any friends. He had to make new friends every year. There were other kinds of conflict in the household. There was religious conflict. His father was a Catholic. His mother was a member of a denomination called the Disciples of Christ, which was a sort of temperance, very closely allied with the temperance movement. Carrie Nation, famously, broke up the bars with her axe, was a disciple of Christ. And I think she was converted to partly as a reaction to the father's drinking. And his brother was, Reagan's older brother was baptized Catholic. Reagan wasn't. You can pull these threads together and see that there was a lot of conflict around religion in the household. There was also, at some point, the father left, had a mistress in another town. The family was very poor. Reagan had a tough childhood. When you hear him talk about it, or when he wrote about it, which he did in this really interesting autobiography he wrote in 1964, which is very little read, called Where's the Rest of Me? Sort of suggestive title. Reagan described it as idyllic. He described it as a Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn childhood. And he talks about walking through the woods and that in this Dixon where he was a lifeguard, he would sit out in the sun and, he famously saved 77 people from drowning, which is true. But he was happy as can be. He lived in his imagination. He loved theater, acting, making up stories, but he describes also just being happy, being out in nature by himself. He said on the Rock River, which ran through Dixon, in the winter it would freeze solid, and you could put on your ice skates and go skate against the wind. So when you came back, you could hold your coat up and it'd be like a sail, and you would just fly back on the river. And he really describes it in these very evocative terms as idyllic. Then you hear what his brother has to say about it. And, his brother said, we had to eat bone soup every night. We begged liver from the butcher and said it was for our cat because we, couldn't afford anything to eat. One year, Dad drank away the money that was supposed to be for Christmas presents and we didn't get any presents. He'd walk right through the screen door, And there are these, you hear these two descriptions of different things. And, Reagan said, well, yeah, my dad did have a drinking problem, but he loved his work. He loved shoes. He loved selling shoes. He was really, it was hard times. He had bad luck that it was during the Depression because he was such a talented salesman. He could have been a real success and had his own business otherwise. And, Reagan was famous for telling his anecdotes and jokes and stories. And one Reagan told all the time, probably his favorite, is this kind of parable of the two sons. The one son is an extreme optimist, and the other son is an extreme pessimist. And the parents are worried about both of them, so they take them to see a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist takes the pessimistic son into this room filled with wonderful toys. And the kid starts crying. And he says, well, they're all just going to break. And he takes the optimistic son in a room filled with horse shit. And the son gets out the shovel and starts digging. He says, with all this crap in here, there must be a pony in there somewhere. And... that's a Reagan story. You realize that's the story about Reagan and his brother, right? These two ways of seeing the same childhood. And what it looked like to me, especially trying to read more deeply into some of Reagan's own writings from the time, including poems and stories he wrote in high school, and as I say, this autobiography, which is really, really interesting, that he wrote on the verge of his political career. I think he developed this ability to live inside his head and to tune out the reality that was hard to take when he was growing up. And it wasn't just a mechanism. It was actually physiological in a lot of ways. Reagan had terrible eyesight. He loved sports when he was growing up, but he couldn't play baseball because he basically couldn't see the ball. He couldn't really even play football very well. The only sport he was really, really good at was swimming, where your eyesight doesn't really matter as much. But he didn't even know his eyesight was bad until he was 13 one time, and he put on his mother's glasses. And he said, "Oh, my God, it's all clear now." And then he took them back off. And he got glasses, but he hated wearing them. He actually, I think, sort of preferred to see the world in these sort of blurrier terms. His hearing was really bad, too. It got substantially worse in his early days in Hollywood when he was making one of the Brass Bancroft films, in which he played a heroic government agent who, you know, breaks up smuggling rings and counterfeiters. And then one of the sets, they fired a gun right next to his ear, basically left him very close to deaf in one ear. And those physical things, his hearing and his eyesight, which were bad, got worse over time. But I think that he turned this sort of what others might see as a weakness and this ability almost to dissociate from reality into a real strength, both a personal strength and a political strength. Reagan had this way of sort of choosing not to hear things. And he chose not to hear things that were either too painful or too contradictory to his beliefs, things that made life too difficult for him. And there were whole episodes in his life, not just his father's alcoholism, but his breakup from this woman he was engaged to through college, who sort of dumped him and broke his heart, his marriage and divorce to Jane Wyman, his getting a lot of help to avoid being drafted at the beginning of the Second World War, some of what he did in Hollywood during the blacklist. He sort of used this facility of tuning out, not hearing, not remembering, to create a reality that comported with his sense of himself and his sense of what was right. And I think it was a tremendous political skill. I think you see when he's in the governor's mansion in Sacramento, and later in the White House, you know, he when you project a lower level of an engagement, if you do it in the right way, the way he did it, you get credit for everything that goes right. But people assume you weren't really connected to the things that go wrong, that was your aides doing this, or, you know, as opposed to being personally responsible. So there's sort of it's a theory of who Reagan was, really, but that he developed this facility, a liability, but a really functional liability in terms of how he related to the world. It had costs. I mean, Reagan didn't have close friends. He wasn't close to any of his children. He was probably personally close to two people in his life: his mother, and we know almost nothing about their relationship because neither of them wrote anything about it, and Nancy, who was the love of his life and who he, I think, understood him better and he felt more understood by than anybody else. But even Nancy said once in an interview, and then when she wrote her book, she said, you know, even I come up against this wall. You can only get so far with Ronnie. He doesn't really let people in. And I think some biographers have taken that quality of impenetrability and said, deduced from that Reagan didn't have an inner life. That's actually what Edmund Morris says. It's not that he didn't have an inner life. Of course he had an inner life. Everybody has an inner life. But he closed off access to it in a way that I think means that we're probably never going to understand how he really thought about himself. What we do understand is what he thought about politics, about all sorts of issues. Reagan, one of the real surprises to me working on this book was that Reagan was a writer, and he was actually a really good writer. He had a very natural narrative frame of mind. His training came as a radio announcer, starting doing sports commentaries I'm sure you've all heard the famous story about when he would provide the color for the Chicago Cubs games. He was in Davenport, Des Moines, Iowa, getting this ticker tape saying play-by-play, you know, ground out, and he had to narrate the game as if he was there. And he, you know, famously one time the ticker tape broke, and he had to wing it for 20 minutes, saying one foul ball after another. And then just when he was about to collapse, the machine came back on, and the guy had fouled out on the first pitch. Reagan had a way he wrote was really the way one writes a radio script. Peggy Noonan, who was the most effective writer he ever had in the White House, was also trained as a radio writer. He wrote for the voice. George Shultz once wrote this very interesting thing about when he was Secretary of State, giving Reagan a speech he was proud of to read, and asking him what he thought. Reagan said, "Well, it's good, George, but it's not how I would do it." And Shultz said, "Well, what do you mean? Now, how would you do it differently?" And Reagan said, "Well, you write for the eye; you write to be read, but I write to be heard." And Reagan wrote. I think he probably wrote every day of his life. He wrote letters, he kept diaries, he wrote this autobiography. And in some ways, the most interesting things he wrote were these radio commentaries he did in the 1970s. First, when he left as governor in 1974, and then he ran for president in 76. Lost to Gerald Ford, then he did them for most of the four-year period before he ran again in 1980. He would do five of them a week. He would record them in batches. He wrote them out longhand. He had no help. He didn't have anybody writing for him until his 1980 presidential campaign. And they're really good. I mean, they're really good version of what they are. They're persuasive. They're human. They're compelling. And, you know, Reagan had a great voice for radio. He had this warm, soothing voice. And but in these commentaries, you see, first of all, completely gives a lie to the idea that, you know, Reagan was a dullard. They're intelligent. He's not an intellectual, but he was original in his thinking. He had a lot of ideas that he develops in these commentaries that were not the sort of standard issue Republican or conservative politics from that period. They didn't match Barry Goldwater, who was a big influence. They didn't match William F. Buckley, who was an influence. Probably the most important thing about them, I think, was that he had this idea that the Soviet Union was vulnerable. And this actually went back to the early 60s. I spent a little time out at the Reagan Library in Simi Valley, and I'd been there a few days going through some papers I was interested in. And the librarian came over to me and said, are you interested in seeing what's in Reagan's desk? And I said, sure, what desk? And she said, well, they packed up the contents. It's not part of the official collection of the library, but we have the boxed contents of the desk. And these were the things that he took with him from his home office in Pacific Palisades to Sacramento, back to Pacific Palisades, to Washington, and then home with him when he left the White House in 1989. And there's a desk diary, and there are these little mementos, and there are sort of odds and ends. You don't know exactly when things were here, when they're there. But there are a couple of speeches, or pieces of writing, I should say. And one piece of writing, which is really not known, is a thing he wrote in 1962 called Are Liberals Really Liberal? And it's basically an essay he wrote. It's sort of written in the form, he wasn't doing radio commentaries, but it's a long essay. And basically the argument he makes is that the Soviet Union is doomed. He thinks, and it's not doomed because it's going to lose in a military conflict. It's doomed because he thinks communism is a violation of human nature. He thinks nobody would want to live like that. It's only, you know, the clock is ticking on how long any people would tolerate living like that. And it's one of these things, you know, you occasionally read something by Reagan where it is both naive and incredibly insightful. And it's a sort of application of common sense to a subject on which there was maybe not that much common sense being applied by a lot of people on the right or arguably on the left. And Reagan, I think he was probably, that idea was actually a little embarrassing on the right. I mean, because it was, there was nobody else who thought that. Nobody else in mainstream politics who was arguing in 1962 that the Soviet Union was just going to fall apart at some point because people wouldn't stand for it anymore. But you find this thread coming up again and again. He quoted actually this piece that was in the typescript in his desk in a radio commentary he did in 1977. He kind of mined some of that material from the unpublished essay. And he comes back again and again to this idea that basically communism is intolerable, but because it's intolerable, it's vulnerable. And you start to see connected with this a really deep antipathy to nuclear weapons. Reagan, part of his interesting early past was he was a pacifist when he was in college in the 1930s. He was very affected by a lot of the literature of the First World War. British anti-war play called Journey's End, which he was taken to see by his girlfriend's parents when he was a sophomore in college, that really moved him. He wrote this short story that's basically a ripoff of Journey's End about the waste of these young men's lives. It comes up again and again at various moments. Reagan, after he was drafted, worked at a place called Camp Roach, which was in Hollywood, and it was essentially where they made all sorts of training and propaganda films for the Army. In 1945, they got the first films from Auschwitz, the liberation of the death camps. And he saw these films. It later gave rise to this total myth that he claimed he'd been involved in liberating Auschwitz, which he never, it was a misunderstanding based on his conversation with some Hebrew speakers who didn't, but he was profoundly affected by this. His son, Ron Jr. said he made him watch these tapes, which he somehow, or film he'd gotten a copy of. It played into this sort of pacifist side. And he when he was running for president the first time, he went to visit the facility in Colorado, which is the deep bunker that's the headquarters of NORAD, the nuclear defense system. And he said, well, what, you know, if the Soviets were to launch a first strike, you know, how do we stop it? And they said, well, it's nothing you do. We launch a counterstrike. And Reagan was so horrified by that idea. He'd never really understood that there was no option other than to respond or not respond. And you start to see in the first term, alongside this defense buildup and this militaristic language and this period when there's actually no direct negotiation with the Soviets for the longest period of the during the Cold War, him trying to reach out to Soviet leaders in this very personal way and saying, we have got to do something to reduce the risk of nuclear conflict and get rid of nuclear weapons. And he starts to say that first in a personal letter he wrote in the hospital when he was recovering from the assassination attempt, 1981, a letter he handwrote to Brezhnev that Al Haig, who was Secretary of State at the time, was vehemently opposed to him sending. And Reagan did end up sending a version of his handwritten letter with a more belligerent cover letter written by the State Department. And then Reagan went on TV and read parts of this letter. And every time there was a new Soviet premier, which there were a whole lot of, his first term, he said, they kept dying on me. You know, but they kept, there was Andropov, Chernenko, and then finally Gorbachev. They kept putting these guys in when they were dying. But each one of them, he would write these letters, multiple handwritten letters, and that was part of what I wanted to see in the Reagan Library, where he says, you know, in different, very personal ways, you and I have the power to destroy the world, and it's terrible. We have to do something to reduce this risk. And one of the things we have to do is we have to have direct line of communication so we don't have some sort of misunderstanding or accident. But I also want you to understand that we don't have any offensive designs towards you. You know, and he would then get back this Soviet boilerplate about Western imperialism and, you know, hegemony, and I think you could just sort of see it. And actually, by the time Gorbachev came to power in 1995, he'd in some ways given up, and he had to be persuaded, partly by Margaret Thatcher, that Gorbachev actually was worth talking to and would respond. But I think the conventional conservative interpretation, if you want the sort of triumphalist view of the end of the Cold War, if you will, is that Reagan drove the Soviet Union into bankruptcy. The defense buildup made them realize they couldn't compete. They essentially capitulated because of his militaristic first-term strategy of challenging the Soviets in every theater, you know, in Central America and Asia. Nothing they did went unchecked by the American military, and we showed that we could build up a much stronger nuclear presence. I don't think that's what happened at all. I think that was certainly an element of Reagan's strategy in the first term, but I think it failed. I think at the end of the first term, he saw that after 4 years, he hadn't been able to make any sort of direct contact with a Soviet leader. There'd been no negotiations. Tensions in the Cold War were as high as they'd ever been. 1983 was probably the low point. But he had come to be seen as this aggressive militaristic figure. And he decided to really pretty radically change strategies. And at that point in the second term, and announces this as soon as he's reelected in a couple of interviews, he became a proponent of really radical disarmament. I mean, disarmament that was so radical that it scared everyone in his own government, because he said, we have to get rid of all nuclear weapons. And lots of people dismissed that as a joke, a fantasy, not real. It was very real from Reagan's point of view. He had a kind of mission to get rid of nuclear weapons. And at that point in his second term, he was essentially surrounded by people who were violently opposed to the thing that he kept saying he wanted. And they dismissed him, they ignored him, they didn't take him seriously. He had one ally, who was George Shultz. And George Shultz was the person who said to the bureaucracy, to the American government, look, this is the president's policy, and we have to take it seriously, and we have to be prepared for the idea that what Reagan proposed it at Reykjavik in 1986, and that negotiation fell apart, but what Reagan was talking about in terms of really radical disarmament might happen. And I think the story of Reagan the second term is, you know, in some ways not the culmination of what he did in the first term, but a kind of reversal and repudiation of that. And when you see Reagan, it was Reagan the peacemaker and Reagan the president who supported Gorbachev, who really, I think, made it possible for Gorbachev to continue with what Gorbachev intended to be a process of reform and repairing communism. But what became very much along the lines of what Reagan talked about in 1962, the collapse of communism once it started to unwind. I'll maybe throw it open in a few minutes. The other thing, which I sort of skipped over, but that I find incredibly interesting and really, really underexamined, is Reagan's political conversion from left to right. So I mentioned he was a pacifist in 1930, but he came from a Democratic family. His father and his brother had jobs in the New Deal. They essentially gave out a version of what became food stamps to people who were unemployed in Dixon, Illinois. They was the kind of household in which FDR was a sort of, you know, almost religious icon. Reagan was a New Deal Democrat. He was a liberal Democrat when he went to Hollywood. And he was a Democrat into the 1950s. The Democrats tried to nominate him for Congress in 1948. He didn't want to run. But he stumped for Harry Truman both times. He didn't actually convert his voter registration to Republican until 1962. But if you go as late as about 1953, he still clearly identifies himself as a liberal Democrat. By 1962, he is more conservative than Barry Goldwater, who is the most conservative person in American politics. So you might ask, what happened? If you read these Reagan biographies, which I've read, you will find in most of them very little about it, other than a few references to, you know, he had a change of heart. Because that period in his life, which I would say is from 1954 to 1962, is almost totally undocumented. It's the period when he worked for General Electric. He was the host of a Sunday night program called the General Electric Theater, which was a sort of playhouse program that would have comedies, dramas, different kinds of things. It was a highly rated program. I think it climbed at one point to 3 in the national ratings. Reagan acted in some of them, but he was the host, and he would introduce this one where he acts opposite James Dean, the only time he appeared opposite James Dean on film. But he also, as part of that job with GE, was a spokesman for GE, and he went around to all the GE facilities. GE had like 130 different factories, offices, research facilities. Reagan, in that 8-year period when he was host of the program, spent months every year going around making speeches on these factory floors and all these facilities. He was the public face of GE. And that's the period in which his politics changed, actually probably mostly towards the beginning of the period. And when I started to look at that, what I found from the quite scanty documentation of that period is you see that he really starts to identify with the corporate perspective of General Electric. General Electric was very against government regulation. It was very against taxes being too high. The chief spokesman for GE is a guy called Lemuel Boulware, who was a big influence on Reagan, I think, although there's no evidence that they ever actually met. But Boulware is the person who coined the phrase business climate, which is a phrase Reagan starts to use, which is basically how well government treats businesses to try to encourage them to locate and prosper in their states. And he shifts in that period, and you can see this in a few speeches he gave, not GE speeches, the speeches he gave elsewhere, from this idea, the sort of Roosevelt idea that business is threatening and government is the solution, to the idea that government is threatening and business is the solution. And I think, he went to an extreme with it, really. Reagan, you could say, by the 1960s, has a view that government can do no right and business can do no evil. And they were sort of twin blind spots of his. But he developed this perspective, and I don't think anybody gave it to him, and I wouldn't make the argument that it was simply, he was a corporate shill for GE. I think he was very influenced by this experience of sort of seeing as a corporation, if you will, and seeing how what GE had was contending with. But it dovetailed with a lot of strands that he'd picked up in the Army, where he'd seen bureaucracy being very wasteful and very ineffective, and particularly with his own experience around taxes, which is interesting. One of the things I tried to do, and was not successful in the book, was I tried to figure out what marginal tax rates Reagan paid in the 1950s and 60s, because he was obsessed with tax rates being too high, and of course, with the 1980 economic reform, drastically lowered them. In 1952, when he went to work for GE, the top tax rate was 84%. And as an actor in Hollywood who was making more than $100,000 a year, Reagan had the first $1 million contract in Hollywood. It was $1 million over 7 years, but it was the first contract where the Warner Brothers or any of the other Hollywood studios signed with seven-figure number on it. He was subject, theoretically, to an 84% tax rate. You could see why you might become a conservative Republican if they paid an 84% tax rate. He didn't pay an 84% tax rate. There was a loophole that said if you were an actor, you could set up a production company, and essentially you paid the capital gains rate. The capital gains tax rate at that point was 25%. But Reagan and a lot of other actors and people of Hollywood were terrified that loophole was going to be closed. And Harry Truman actually proposed closing that loophole along with putting a 20% tax on entertainment. If you bought a movie ticket, there was a 20% tax on it, depending on the movies. So Reagan thought both they were the government was discriminating unfairly against Hollywood and the industry, which he represented as the head of the Screen Actors Guild and a bunch of other positions. But also, when he went to work for GE, he was faced with the prospect of his tax rate going from 25%. to 84%. I don't think he paid 84%, but I don't know what he did pay. Probably he had to pay a higher share of his income in taxes. But that was his obsession about personal tax rates melded very naturally with GE's focus on corporate taxes and the business climate. And I think that's a period that is, you have to look at what happened there if you want to understand how Ronald Reagan became Ronald Reagan. It also had to do with a lot of the kind of reading he was doing at the time. Reagan read Hayek, he read Whitaker Chambers, he was a charter subscriber to National Review. He was a reader as well as a writer his whole life, and you know, and all these things influenced them. But again, I think he had an original filter he put on things. His views were not anybody else's views. They were his views. Maybe I'll wrap it up there and throw it open to anything anyone would like to ask or talk about. Yeah.
I'd like to remind our audiences online and the radio that they're listening to Jacob Weisberg speaking about his autobiography of, biography of Ronald Reagan. That would be a nice trick. And it's time for questions and answers, and I'll get the microphone.
Yes, sir.
One of the criticisms, especially in California, is that this was sort of a cold-hearted guy where he shut down all these mental institutions. He shut down the mental institutions and put people out mentally ill out on the street. He, was in the process of at least damping down contributions for education and the University of California. What about this aspect? Is that an unfair accusation?
In many ways, I think it is. I think Reagan was a pretty successful governor of California, and I think he was a very moderate governor of California. And you see when he took office, his pragmatic side start to kick in terms of the need to work with a Democratic-controlled legislature. Reagan said, anytime I can get 70% of what I want from a legislature controlled by the other party, I'll take it. And so he was a deal maker. But particularly on those issues. I mean, first of all, in his time in office, Reagan more than doubled state spending in California. He raised taxes a lot. It was one of those things where there was a kind of dissonance between what he said he was doing, and maybe even what he thought he was doing, and what he was actually doing. But Reagan greatly increased spending on higher education in California, despite his role as the sort of public face of the opposition to the Berkeley free speech movement and his seeming hostility to public education. His environmental record was very good. I mean, he protected all sorts of land in California, designated scenic rivers. People who look back at his record argue, you know, it's quite reasonable. And, you know, on a lot of issues, I mean, it's funny now when you think of Reagan in the context of the Republican primary, in which he's constantly evoked. He would be thrown out of today's party for any number of reasons. Not to say Reagan was a liberal. I mean, as governor of California, he was a conservative Democrat. He was very opposed to welfare. He started the idea of workfare, of replacing welfare with work, which ultimately culminated in the Clinton reforms. I mean, his views were genuinely conservative in many ways, but Reagan was always pro-immigration, and I think he had particularly a Southern Californian perspective on immigration, which is that if you don't have free flow back and forth across the border, the fruit doesn't get picked. I mean, it was a business necessity to have a relatively open border. And he said in his 1984 debate with Walter Mondale, "I believe in amnesty for people who have lived here, even if they came here illegally." Amnesty is his phrase, and the immigration reform he signed as president in 1987 had the amnesty that everybody, you know, that's where that dirty word comes from in Republican politics. He was for handgun control after Jim Brady was shot and so terribly injured in the assassination attempt in 1981. He was a gun owner. He believed in the Second Amendment as he interpreted it, but he thought there had to be reasonable controls, particularly on, you know, the ability of a John Hinckley who was mentally ill to buy a handgun in a pawn shop for $20. Of course, Reagan probably did more than any other political figure in the 60s to make abortion legal around the country. He later regretted that, and he said he regretted it, but he signed the therapeutic abortion bill in California in 1967, which essentially said that a woman's doctor can decide whether she needs an abortion for psychological reasons, and that meant that abortion wasn't technically legal, but was effectively legal. And that's because California is so influential. That spread around the country. But, you know, imagine in the next Republican debate being the one saying there, well, I know I basically legalized abortion, but I'm really sorry. I think Reagan would be, you know, a sort of outre figure in a lot of ways in today's party. I got a little bit off your point about California, but I think Reagan's California record is not the record of an arch conservative. It's much more the record of a reasonably effective pragmatist conservative moderate.
I had a question for you.
Yeah.
Based on what I've read, is that Reagan was moving to the right well before 1950, and you're saying it's mostly after 1953. I mean, was there a specific event? Usually there's some kind of cathartic event where people flip and they go the other direction, and that's my experience with people like him. His orientation to the world. And because, like you said, he tunes out what he didn't want to hear. But at some point in time, he was hearing the left rather than the right. So there must have been something in there. And when he was in the Army Signal Corps, he said he sort of started moving to the right because he was hanging out with all the Army fellow, you know, officers. And there was a lot more right-wing influence there. And that was, I did read something about that. So can you elaborate more on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, he talks about in Where's the Rest of Me, in his autobiography he published in 1965, he talks about working for GE as his graduate course in political science and the period when he flipped. He says there that, look, when I look back on it, there are things that were bothering me about liberalism earlier on. One of them was in the Army, the ineffectiveness of bureaucracy. He really got this idea of government being wasteful and ineffective really sort of hit him when he was at Camp Roach in the 50s. There are other strands. I mean, obviously the battle around House on American Activities and communism in Hollywood, I think in that fight you see him shifting from being a liberal anti-communist to being not a McCarthyite, because he never really was, but he was he became a conservative anti-communist. And, you know, Reagan testified before the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1947. He went in Washington. You read his testimony today. He's great. I mean, he stood up for. He said, you know, first of all, he refused to name names, although he was probably naming them privately as an informer for the FBI. But he said, I can't give you any names because I don't have any evidence that people are communist. I might have my suspicions. He said, but he said Hollywood is handling this fine. They said these views haven't made it into the movies, and people have a right to think what they think. And he opposed the idea of making the Communist Party illegal. And he said, you know, if American people have the information, they can make up their own minds. That's what he said in 1947. And then as the blacklist developed, and he became a figure in it through his role in the Screen Actors Guild and through MPIC. And he essentially became someone who was a vetter of other his fellow actors, both actors who would come to him and say, I've been wrongly accused, or confused with someone who's a communist, or, you know, I'm blacklisted and I shouldn't be. He would help those people out. But he also ended up playing a really significant role in, you know, maintaining the unofficial blacklist. Of course, he never acknowledged that a blacklist existed. But his experience with Hollywood communism, I think, was certainly part of what shifted his views. And it's part of what formed this common sense, this common sense idea I was talking about communism being antithetical to human nature. He thought these Hollywood communists, so many of them in the Writers Guild, he just thought they were ridiculous. I mean, he kind of had contempt for their views, and there was a lot of the Screen Actors Guild, which he ran, was a much more mainstream at the time union as compared to the writers, which was the union that many of the Hollywood 10 members came from. So, you know, I think you can put together these different strands, but Reagan still self-identified as a liberal. He still campaigned for Harry Truman in 1952. it wasn't until he went to work for GE that you see him start to identify and talk like a conservative.
It seems to me that as a country, we elect more than our fair share of entertainers and actors. And I wonder if you think Reagan belongs in that conversation along with, you know, Schwarzenegger and possibly Trump, and what that says about the American system.
Yeah, I think Reagan certainly took advantage of the skills he developed. In some ways more as a radio entertainer than as a film actor. He was much better on radio than he was on film. He after he lost in 1976, CBS offered him this job doing the commentaries on the CBS Nightly News to be a conservative opposite Eric Severide, who was the liberal. And that was probably, anybody would have said at the time, that's the most powerful purge to do political commentary in the United States. And Reagan said, I don't want to do it because people get tired of looking at me. He said, but I want to do these radio commentaries instead, because when people hear your voice but don't see your face, they use their own imaginations to fill in parts of the story that you're talking about. And I think, you know, he really understood how to use his voice. I mean, he was the great communicator that way. And he had discipline as a performer and an entertainer. You know, he would come in, this was one of his advantages in Hollywood. He wasn't a great actor, but he was a very, very reliable actor. He was on time. He was disciplined. He knew his lines. He showed up. He stood ready. And he did the same thing as president. You know, he followed the stage directions. He understood what it meant to be directed. And he took direction very well. So I think those were all skills that he used. But I think it underestimates him and misunderstands him to really classify him that way. Because I think when you start to read what Reagan wrote in the period and start to see what happened to him, he was trying to get away from that. I mean, he didn't want to be an actor anymore. He knew his limitations as an actor. He went into politics because he had a set of views and cared about the issues he cared about, and he took that very seriously. He made jokes about, you know, when he was elected governor, I've never played a governor before, I don't know what to do. But, you know, he didn't really think that way. He really changed from an actor to a politician, even as he drew on the toolkit he'd built up earlier.
We had an author in here a couple years ago who had done a book on Reagan's election as governor the first time and how he kind of ran against Berkeley, which is, of course, a big issue, and the free speech movement. Is there anything you can say about that? That was also part of being an FBI informant and that kind of thing, and that he used that as his wedge issue. Do you see it that way in his run for California governor?
It really arose during his first campaign for governor, and he latched onto it, and it was part of it was a manifestation of his good political instincts, because I think he had political advisors telling him it wasn't particularly a good issue, and he became this sort of national face of opposition to the student radicals. Reagan was not an angry person. He was very funny, and in that situation, though it was a very intense conflict, he always used humor in a certain way to help win people over to his side. You know, I mean, there are lots of sort of anecdotes about him, but you know, there was, when he was visiting one of the UCAL campuses, I forget which one, and he's in a limousine, and the protesters, these hippies, are banging on the glass, and it's like a tense situation, like they're gonna turn his car over. And one of these kids holds up a sign to the window that says, "We are the future." Reagan scrawls on a piece of paper, holds up to the window, "I'm selling my bonds." he was vilified, obviously, at the period, but during the period, but he was, I think he was a hard person to hate, because he was fundamentally good-natured person, who was sort of appalled by what was going on, in a way that a lot of middle-aged, middle-class moderate people were at the time, which is that, you know, these students are being subsidized in their education, and they're not going to class, they're engaged in this sort of frolic which we shouldn't be supporting. He turned it into a mainstream issue in a way that, you know, other politicians who opposed it, I mean, you think about Spiro Agnew or, you know, other politicians on the right who presented a much uglier, harsher face and reaction to the 60s protests.
Thanks. Would you mind if I shift the subject to your mom? I love Chicago, and I had no idea that I owe so much of what I love about it to her, reading the pieces. Can you just share something about her, a favorite story?
Oh, well, that's very kind of you. My mother passed away recently, and she was a political figure in Chicago. She was ran the Department of Cultural Affairs in Chicago for many years, and so she was a figure in the arts in Chicago, and I don't know. We've been, you know, remembering a lot of stories about her. I'll give you one at random, which I was thinking of today. My mom was very clued in about a lot of things, but not about pop culture. And I had many horrifying moments, and when I was a teenager, where I would see her across the room, you know, sometimes talking to a rock star. Like, I remember one time with Keith Richards. And, you know, I see them wrapped in conversation at backstage at this event. I think, my God, what is she saying? This is so embarrassing. What's she saying to Keith Richards? And then she came over afterwards, or I went over to her. And, you know, Keith Richards looked terrible. I mean, he had a whiskey bottle and a cigarette. And it was like peak Keith Richards. And I said, Mom, do you know who that was? And she said, no, who's that? He was such a nice boy. And of course, the other one, like, that was, she actually staged, I think, the first city that observed Martin Luther King Day as a holiday was Chicago, before it was a national holiday. She worked for Harold Washington, the first black mayor of Chicago, and they had this celebration. And she was sitting next on the stage. She was sitting next to Stevie Wonder. And I was watching him talking, wrapped in conversation this whole time. And when she came down afterwards, I said, you know, Mom, you know, what did Stevie Wonder say? She said, oh, he was wonderful. We talked about everything. She said, but, you know, he doesn't really look at you when he talks to you. Her knowledge of pop culture, I think, stopped with the Beatles.
I've heard commentary that Reagan was really very intellectual, but didn't want to show that. Have you seen that or found that?
Well, you know, there was the great Saturday Night Live version of Reagan, of course, where everyone leaves the room, and, you know, he then becomes the mastermind who's actually running everything and just pretending to be adult when they're in the room. The way I would frame it is, I don't think Reagan was not an intellectual, but I don't think he was in any way unintelligent, and I think he was both very literate. He was a reader. He read books. He watched a lot more movies, but he read books. And he was an original thinker in the sense that he didn't borrow his ideas from other people. He came to things in his own way. And I think you can respect his intellect, but at the same time acknowledge its limitations, is how I would frame it.
What did research on this book challenge any preconceptions you had about Reagan? Were you surprised to find some things out about him that you didn't know?
All of it. I mean, I really, you know, I grew up in a liberal household. I grew up very anti-Reagan, not sympathetic to him in any way. And I think, you know, my conclusion from the book is to, you know, put it in a nutshell in a way, is that, you know, people who dislike Reagan should appreciate him for a lot of reasons, including Reagan as a peacemaker. And I think he was a transformational figure in that respect. But the people who do like Reagan generally like him for the wrong reasons. You know, they have a wrong idea of what he did. And that's partly because so much of his rhetoric was at odds with the reality. And if you, you know, again, in the sort of context of the Republican primary, Reagan is held up as this man of pure principle who wouldn't give in and wouldn't compromise and had this uncompromising vision, and finally, you know, people bent to his will. That's not what happened. I mean, Reagan had a big tax cut in 1981. He increased taxes in 1982, 1983, 1984, 1985, 1986, and 1987. I don't think he did in 1988. You know, the size of the government increased during the Reagan years. Partly that's a reflection of pragmatism. Partly that's in some cases a reflection of areas where things got away from him, and he maybe didn't fully understand the extent to which what was happening was not what he thought he was doing. But you know, I think sort of almost all of the cliches you hear about Reagan are shibboleths in some way. And I think there's more reinterpreting to be done.
Well, there's one famous shibboleth is when he got shot, you know, in the assassination attempt, and then he went to the hospital and he made these jokes, "I hope you're all Republicans." You know, and a lot of people didn't like him up until that point. Yeah. You know, I mean, he'd been president for a while, and of course, a part of the thing, but his approval rating was up to 90% then.
Yeah.
And I thought that showed two things. One, how attractive a president with a real sense of humor, not just a staged one, was. Yeah. And the second one, the 10% of the people are going to be mad at anybody who 90% of the people like.
Yeah.
You know? So, but did you think that was a transformative thing in his popularity with the people who disagreed with him?
Well, look, it was a crucial moment, partly because, you know, Tip O'Neill, who was the Speaker of the House, up until that point was deciding whether to how hard to resist Reagan on the 81 economic plan. And after he was shot, Tip O'Neill essentially threw in the towel and said, "He's too popular now. We can't oppose him anymore. We have to give him this and then fight on other things and fight on the margins." But yes, I think that's authentic. I mean, there are questions, of course, whether Reagan actually said all of those things, whether some of them, you know, these were lines that were handed out to the press. In fact, the reality was much more dire than anybody knew at the time. He was very close to dying. It was really covered up and presented in a misleading way. But the part that was real was Reagan's grace in that situation. You know, he was a kind man. I mean, on the one hand, nobody really knew him, and people didn't feel they could really get close to him. On the other hand, there's hardly anyone who describes a negative experience with him other than sort of being forgotten by him when they were no longer in the picture. You know, he would sit at his desk in the Oval Office and read his mail from people, and often he would get these hard luck stories. And he would write people checks, you know, and say, "Hope this helps you." And then he would find out they wouldn't cash the check. And he would say, "Well, you can keep that one for a souvenir, but here's another one that I really want you to cash." You know, and he would read the newspaper and hear these hard luck stories, and he would intervene. I mean, he would pick up the phone and try to get people jobs. I mean, he had this kindness at a human level. I mean, in some ways, it's the only way he could relate to abstract issues was around people's individual stories. But I think his popularity is a reflection of that kind of humanity and good nature, as well as of his skills as a communicator.
One of the themes that we hear when we hear the Republican debates these days is, you know, how much Washington is hated and how much Washington is a problem. So as a governor going, you know, being elected, what were his ideas about Washington, and how did he, you know, in a sense, come to terms and you know, find his way in Washington?
I think he started that. I mean, I really do. And, you know, when he ran for president in 1976, and, you know, his announcement in 1975, he said essentially, first person really to use that language, you know, "I'm not a member of the Washington establishment." He was the first person really to vilify Washington in exactly that way, the idea that there was this sort of parasitic class, and that Washington was the enemy of the people. Certainly conservatives, Goldwater, lots of conservatives were anti-government. They wanted less government. But they didn't use that particular kind of language. And a version of that is what has been a dominant strain in conservative politics ever since. And, you know, I think it coincided with a decline in trust in government, a decline in the belief that, that government could be a force for good, which comes out of the 1960s and the Vietnam War that Reagan both capitalized on and exploited during his 1980 presidential campaign, but that paradoxically he diminished in office because he was a popular president and ultimately seen as a successful president. Confidence in government started to go up a little bit, even though he was vilifying it.
One of the many ironies. So we have time for one question, one more question. We'd like to ask the last question. Okay. That was great.
We covered
that.
Thank
was
you
a great
very
set
much.
Of stories. Thank you. Really, really wonderful. And the book has more.
Yes. And the book. Very happy to sign a copy for anyone.
Exactly. Yeah. The book's out there. So thank you very much for coming to the live audience here in San Francisco. So ends another event in the 113th year of the Commonwealth Club's History of Enlightened Discussion. Thank you very much.